It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin project aims to understand the roots of prejudice and stereotypes and to help us overcome them in our daily lives. First, it's time for the Week in Washington, when we look at the biggest stories in national politics. Independence Day just passed, and it wasn't a typical one for GOP politicians this year. In some states, the celebrations were overshadowed by tension and questions about the Republican health care bill aimed at replacing the Affordable Care Act. You can share your thoughts on the future of the GOP health care bill by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post over on the Central Time Facebook page. Harry Anton joins us now to talk about that topic and many more. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
We usually see politicians run into the spotlight on the 4th of July, attending parades and other kinds of events. What was different this year, especially for Republican senators?
Well, it seemed that they didn't want to run into the spotlight. Look, you had senators like Cory Gardner, who's in the swing state of Colorado, even though he's not up for re-election in 2018. He is up for re-election 2020, and you see him basically staying home, not wanting to march in these parades. Why? Because we know how unpopular the Republican health care plan is, and they don't want to be basically bullied at these parades and saying, you better not vote for this thing. They want to stay away from that and stay away from the crowds.
What about the Republican senators who have said that they will not vote for the current health care bill as it stands, at least?
You know, we did see, in fact, Susan Collins, who's obviously a moderate Republican up in the state of Maine. She actually got congratulations from a lot of her constituents thanking her for not voting for it. Up and down the parade route, she, in fact, said as much. Or if you go up into Alaska with Lisa Murkowski, who's, you know, seen as a swing vote on this piece of legislation, she, in fact, said that although people weren't necessarily telling her to vote one way or another, in fact, perhaps just vote for the best for Alaska, those people who did, in fact, demonstrate a position said, we hope you vote against this. And I think that's just what you see nationwide. There's a lot of enthusiasm against this bill. It's not just that it's unpopular, but those who hold enthusiasm about it are very much against it.
And did protesters use especially the occasion of the 4th, a very patriotic holiday, as an opportunity to criticize this bill?
Sure. I think part of it obviously is being the 4th and the idea that, you know, this is America's day. This is the day where, you know, we demonstrate our political power and our political will and the willingness to speak out against authority. But I think it was also just an opportunity where if, you know, you're marching in a parade, obviously you're a sitting duck. You're someone who has to listen to the voices that are coming in from the outside. And Democrats have done a very good job so far, or people at least who are you know, let's say in line with Democratic ideas, have done a very good job of organizing and making sure that their voices are held, whether it be a parade or be at these town halls that we saw earlier this year about health care.
And Mitch McConnell is pretty much the face of the Republican effort right now. How was he received back in his district?
I don't think that Mitch McConnell, you know, this bill, what is so amazing to me about this bill is that it's uniformly unpopular. In fact, we ran a piece, a few months ago that basically said that even in the reddest of districts, this is not a particularly well-liked bill. Whether, you know, you go down to Alabama or you go north into New York, this is just a bill that isn't particularly well-liked. And it's not a bill that's well-liked among Republicans. And that's what I think is so interesting about it, is that they've managed to craft a bill that is not well-liked by pretty much anyone across the political spectrum.
You said that people who agree with what would be identified as Democratic positions about the health care bill did a good job of using the holiday and using access to their representatives to push their point. What about the Democratic establishment? Have they been using the opposition that's been coming up for Republicans to their benefit?
I think that they have for the most part. Obviously, Democrats have done a good job of unifying around a single position early on. There weren't any Democrats in the House who voted for the Republican health care bill, and there weren't any Democrats in the Senate who said that they'd vote for this current version of the health care bill. And Democrats have done a good job of fundraising, a good job of getting out there and offering their message. I think that there are some issues where Democrats are divided, but health care is definitely not one of them. This is one where Democrats across the board are uniformly basically in line and being very much against this health care bill. And that's something that can't be said the same for Republicans, who are much more split on it, especially Republican voters.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now, taking a look at the week in politics in Washington. He is senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, let's move on to President Trump and his continuing, I would say battle, perhaps, with the media. And some of the biggest news over the weekend was a tweet he sent out in which he was punching and body slamming someone with a CNN logo superimposed on their head. What kind of fallout has there been since that?
Well, I would, you know, say that there has been fallout. And to be clear, what exactly occurred was Donald Trump in his pre-presidential days, you know, obviously was an entertainer. He appeared in many movies. He also appeared in the World Wrestling Entertainment a match. He wrestled in one match. Obviously, that World Wrestling Entertainment, although, you know, is certainly dangerous to take part in, is not real. It's scripted. And what essentially happened was he was body slamming one of the opponents or one of the mock opponents, and someone put a picture of FNN, you know, fake news network or whatever it was, right on his face of the opponent. And so, you know, a lot of people interpreted that as him saying that violence against the media was okay. That, of course, was an interpretation. Some, I think, people who were perhaps more fans of Donald Trump would argue this was a fake thing, you know, and he's just saying, I don't like, you know, the fake news media. But among people who are certainly members of the media, they took it as a threat against them. And remember, it was no more than a month ago, I think, that in the state of Montana, or maybe it's a little bit more than a month ago, in the state of Montana, where a Republican candidate for the House literally did body slam a reporter. So I think reporters are very, very sensitive about that.
And this is actually coming close on the heels of President Trump criticizing MSNBC host Mika Brzezinski and talking about her once as, quote, still bleeding badly from a facelift. So how is the White House trying to handle the kind of constant fallout around these tweets right now focused on the media?
You know, it's so difficult. I give no one in that White House who doesn't necessarily know what Trump's going to tweet, you know, it's a very, very difficult job for them. Obviously, some of them, some of the people who are closer to Trump try and defend him as much as they possibly can. Others perhaps offer no comments, and certainly Republicans who are outside of the administration have been very much against those tweets. Indeed, you know, one of the conversations we had at 538 in a piece that will be coming out relatively shortly was basically about how the media can team up with Republicans and come out against Trump for his personal comments, whether it be the body slamming or the comments against women like he had against Mika Brzezinski, and there can be a unified effort against that because it's not being seen as partisan. The media is much more willing to critique Trump on issues that aren't, say, you know, tax cuts or the health care bill, something that's more along the lines of what is generally deemed as presidential activity or presidential material or the way a president should act. Essentially, the media is very much willing to critique Trump on that, and so are his fellow Republicans. And so it hasn't been necessarily a good week for Trump from that perspective.
Are there efforts, do you think, within the White House staff to try to either limit how much the president is tweeting or the topics on which he's expressing himself?
Sure. I mean, you know, look, we always get these reports out from unnamed sources that people within the White House wish that Trump would stay on topic on Twitter. But the fact of the matter is Donald Trump's a grown man and is going to tweet whenever he wants to tweet. And there's no one who can really tell Donald Trump, the President of the United States, not to tweet. I do think at times it certainly takes Trump off of message and opens him to critiques that perhaps he wishes he weren't open to. But on the other end of the equation, you know, it does take the media's eye off of the health care ball, which is a very unpopular bill. And instead, we're talking about Trump's tweets, which, although, you know, most people would agree, if you look at polling, that they wish he didn't tweet as much. When it comes down to who do you trust more, the media or, say, CNN, Republicans are very much in the corner of Donald Trump, while perhaps the overall electorate's more divided. So it's not necessarily clear that his tweeting hurts him, although I'm pretty sure it doesn't help him.
On the topic of tweeting, National Public Radio has a tradition of broadcasting the Declaration of Independence each 4th of July, having a variety of their on-air and off-air voices reading segments of it. But this year, they decided to kind of update that a little. In addition to the broadcast, they also tweeted out the whole document line by line. What happened as a result?
Well, Some people didn't really seem to know what was going on. They critiqued the tweets that were coming out from NPR, thinking that they were political in some way. They thought, you know, especially when it came to the sections over King George and fighting back against a king or a tyrant, that they were talking about Trump. They thought that somehow this was political in some way, when in fact it wasn't at all. Which I guess speaks in one way to the ignorance of some people on Twitter, which isn't so much of a surprise if you're on Twitter, but in another way I think speaks to the fact that people of a certain political point of view are going to think that anything that's coming out of the media or their Twitter account is somehow a critique of the president when it's no such thing.
What I find really interesting about that, Harry, is that I think in a way that really hasn't happened, at least not for many, many, many years, people actually, well, first of all, read the Declaration of Independence in short bursts like that, but also really saw what a revolutionary document it was in the first place.
Yeah, you know, I think that, look, it sometimes can be, you know, if you're an American right now, I mean, some people's lives change dramatically when we go from one president to the next. But, you know, for most people, we're going about our everyday lives the same way that we did last year, even if we liked or didn't like the president who was elected. But, you know, back in 1776, that was a real revolution. That was a real war that was being fought. That was speaking out against the current leader at the time, you know, the King of England. And that was somebody who threatened death to those who went against him. That's a real revolution. That's not a political revolution that some in this country argue that we should have. That was a bloody revolution, one in which arms were taken up, and that's a very, very different situation than what we see right now in this country.
You mentioned, Harry, that some Trump supporters especially took issue with it, thinking that it was aimed at the current president instead of the past king. And were there others that had any problem with the NPR presentation of the Declaration of Independence in that format?
I think that, you know, people just generally, you know, get confused. There were a lot of tweets from a lot of different people who were like, why are you doing this? What is this about? People who just didn't even know what was going on. But, you know, at the end of the day, I just go back to the whole thing that I think that it does in some ways speak to a misunderstanding of what exactly the Declaration of Independence is and what it means to this country. And I think that, if someone had just posted a tweet of the entire Declaration of Independence at one time and that people understood what was going on, that would have been one thing. But I think in these short little spats that on Twitter, I think sometimes the nuance can get lost, that people are just joining midstream. But it's also the fact that, you know, the Declaration of Independence is a whole document. That's what makes it so great. It's line to line that makes it great as a whole, not necessarily one individual line which doesn't tell a whole story. And sometimes I think on Twitter that can get lost, that entire story.
There's an update on efforts by the Environmental Protection Agency to at least slow down some Obama-era regulations. Environmentalists recently had a win after the EPA tried to delay implementation of methane regulations. What exactly happened there, Harry?
Well, essentially, you know, the EPA under President Trump is obviously a very different organization than it was, or member, a part of the administration than it was under Barack Obama. And there were all these things about introducing new methane regulations that Scott Pruitt, who's the head of the EPA, wanted essentially to delay. And the D.C. Circuit Court said, that's not going to happen. You can't do that. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously this is another example of Trump getting, quote-unquote, beat in the courts. The lower courts so far of this administration, whether it be the EPA or whether it be the immigration ban, have not ruled favorably for this president. And I think, you know, it does set up a battle, at least for the rest of this administration, between the lower courts and the Trump administration, where they're not going to allow him in their minds to get away with stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, obviously a lot of this will come down to what the higher courts end up deciding. But again, this basically throws another cog in the wheel. You know, it's just another thing that the Trump administration, as it's quote-unquote trying to change Washington, has just faced a lot of difficulty from these lower courts, and I'm not sure if that's going to end anytime soon.
We're recapping the week's biggest stories in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what your reactions are to Republican senators trying to move their new health care bill forward. Did it affect your 4th of July or how you saw Independence Day? And tell us what you thought about President Trump's tweet of a video of him punching and body slamming CNN. Do you think it crossed a line? What do you think of the White House response? That's 800-642-1234 to join in or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to that after this short break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up the conversation now with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. We're looking at the week's top stories from Washington, D.C. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What are your reactions to the president's tweet of him beating up CNN? Do you think the president should be able to do that given Twitter's own rules of use? Do you think he crossed a line? Also, NPR recently tweeted out the entire Declaration of Independence. What are your thoughts on some people's reactions? And how would you react? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Harry, I just want to touch back on something we were talking about, the Trump administration having another defeat in the courts, this time about the EPA trying to delay implementation of Obama-era methane regulations. You know, one of the things that's been coming out recently is how far behind the Trump administration is in filling a lot of posts within the administration. Do you think in some way this is a reflection of that, that they just don't have as deep the knowledge and experience that maybe they need to be able to craft these things in a more effective way?
Yeah, absolutely, that's the case. And, you know, I think that you see that with the EPA. And, you know, as I mentioned before, when we're talking about, you know, decisions that the courts have reversed Trump on, I think you saw that with the immigration ban as well. You know, they came out with that, and it was clearly very rushed, and it was people who didn't necessarily know how to put things together and things that would easily be struck down by courts when they could have worded it differently, perhaps gotten it by the courts. Words matter. You know, maybe they don't matter when Trump is tweeting out or what Trump says, but words matter in documents that are going to be interpreted as law. And courts are very, very careful about parsing those words and what exactly, you know, these different regulations mean or what these different directives mean. And if you don't have the people in the positions that are necessary to review the documents that are going to be presented to the public or be law, then it could leave yourself open to a lot of different fault lines in the courts to overrule your administration.
And do we know where those delays or roadblocks are coming from? Because recent reports were that U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had kind of a meltdown and was very upset about how many key positions had gone unfilled in the State Department.
You know, I just think they're happening all over the place. And to me, that's just an administration that doesn't have itself well put together and hasn't, you know, put the priority on filling these positions. And it was only when, you know, the press started pointing it out that they start filling some of the positions that have been left open. But, you know, at one point, I think it was like 900 positions that had not been, you know, that haven't been appointed that should have been. And that's crazy that we're this far into the administration. You know, we're nearly half a year in, and there's still so many posts that have not been filled yet. I think it just speaks to an incompetence in a way that may be uncomfortable for this administration to deal with. But, you know, get some people in these positions, and then you wouldn't leave yourself open to the criticism. I don't think that's a partisan critique. I think it's a competence critique.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Greg in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thanks. I was in San Francisco last weekend at a jazz fest, and someone had a large poster of a Photoshop of the image of Muhammad Ali standing over Sonny Liston, but Trump was in the where Liston was. So this is kind of Photoshop against Trump, and I'm wondering why we don't see more of that on CNN.
All right, thanks for that call, Greg. You're breaking up just a little bit. Harry, do you think it would be effective if there was more hit back, no pun intended, to these kinds of tweets and other kinds of messaging?
You know, I think, if I heard the caller correctly, I think one of the reasons why you haven't seen, you know, necessarily why the CNN thing became so big with, you know, the photoshopping of, you know, the FNN or whatever on the body that was getting body slammed by Trump was because if there's one thing the media likes to talk about, it's itself. right? I think that was part of the reason why this thing has so taken off and why, for instance, CNN made such an effort to find out who the person was who created the meme of, you know, having the CNN logo or the fake CNN logo on the face of the person getting body slammed by Trump. But, I think we see photoshopping all the time on Twitter. But I think the reason why this one took added importance was because, it featured a major news organization, and major news organizations, for the most part, aren't going to take that lying down.
And how much do we know about the person that created that? I know the Anti-Defamation League said that it was created by a Reddit user with a history of bigotry. What's the story there?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a person on a pro-Trump sub-forum, someone who in the past had pointed out that, at least according to the reporting, however accurate that is, that this is a person who previously had pointed out that there were a lot of Jewish people, for instance, at CNN, and pointed out who those people were. Additional reporting suggests that it's a middle-aged male, but we don't necessarily know who that person is for sure. CNN, even though they claim to know who it was, has not released that name, at least for the time being.
Let's move on to Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor. He was recently photographed sunbathing at a family party on a beach that had been closed to the public because the New Jersey government was shut down because of a budget impasse. What kind of reaction has there been?
I would say that this is probably the easiest score ever for people who want to come out against a politician on either side of the aisle. Universal condemnation of Chris Christie, whose approval rating in New Jersey, despite once being sky high, was only at 15% in the most recent Quinnipiac poll. Nobody in that state likes Chris Christie, except for maybe his wife and his children. They got to go to the beach. Of course, my favorite thing was that someone claimed that Christie was not sunbathing, and then when they showed him the picture, he said, yeah, he's wearing a hat. Therefore, he wasn't actually getting any sun. I mean, this is just a politician who realizes that his term ends at the end of this year and has no future in electoral politics whatsoever and is basically saying, forget about it. I'm going to do what I want. And I think that very much shows, and the public has had enough of Chris Christie, and I think Chris Christie has had enough of the New Jersey public.
Well, the New Jersey public, he was really angling hard to get a position in the Trump administration. He is preparing to leave the governor's office. Is there any future for him in Washington?
I don't put anything past Donald Trump, but the fact of the matter is that Chris Christie was already someone who was basically running during the period where Trump was preparing for the White House. He was running the transition, and Trump got rid of him. I'm not sure there's much of a future for Christie, even in the Donald Trump administration, although maybe you surprise us. I think at the end of the day, Chris Christie's future may be as a sports talk radio show host in New York City, which I actually think he'd be kind of good at.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us for the Week in Washington, where we recap the top stories in national politics. Issues of race and discrimination have been part of many of the big stories in the United States over the last few years, including police-involved shootings, disparities in education and income, the rise of the alt-right, prison reform, and more. And the idea of implicit bias or unconscious prejudice has gotten a lot of attention as well. A UW-Madison project is working to measure bias and stereotypes by race, gender, and other categories, and to figure out how to help people overcome their prejudice. Patricia Devine is a professor of psychology and director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison. Rob Ferret spoke with her last month.
Well, how do you start to measure things like implicit or unconscious bias in a person?
Well, it started out as a rather tricky endeavor, and the hope was that we could get sort of straightforward measures of these types of biases. And so early in my career, we looked at sort of indirect indicators, just whether people said stereotypes popped to mind, or once a stereotype was activated, did it influence judgments of others, say somebody doing an ambiguously hostile behavior and you had prime stereotypes of African Americans, it would lead to biased judgments, more hostility than if you had not primed those ideas or made them highly accessible. But in recent years, people have developed more direct indicators like the implicit association test, or IAT, that Tony Greenwald at the University of Washington developed some years ago. And basically, this is a reaction time measure that we call it a dual categorization categorization task. You're looking at faces of black and white people and then positive and negative words, and you're sort of doing a sorting task. The bottom line is that as you go through this task, it gives you an indication of the strength of association between black and white people and positive and negatively valenced information. The typical pattern we see in white Americans in this country is that they more strongly associate white Americans with positive valenced information and black Americans with negative valenced information.
And then how do we see this kind of bias play out outside of the lab in the real world? How does this implicit bias that we may not be aware of manifest itself?
Yeah, so I like to talk about it as unintentional bias,
okay.
Right? I think that, to my mind, that's a clearer way to think about these kinds of issues. And let me tell you about a study that was done with gender as the context. And Moss Rakeson and their colleagues, they did an experiment where they took applications and randomly assigned male and female names to the applications and sent them out to STEM professors. So this is the science, technology, engineering, and math kind of professors. And they were interested in whether the identically credentialed male and female would receive different treatment, be less likely to be hired as a lab manager. So that was the position. It turns out it's an important position. It's your entry into the field. And what they found is that both male and female professors evaluated the male applicant more favorably, found him to be more competent, worthy of more mentoring, and worthy of a higher salary than the female applicant. Now, keep in mind, it's the exact same set of credentials.
The only difference is the name that sounds more like a male or a female.
That's right. Jane Doe, John Doe. You could think about it that way. So that's the only difference across the applications. And most people believe that those professors were not intentionally discriminating against the women, that there is something about the stereotype that men are better at math and science than women that influenced their interpretation unintentionally, and they weren't really aware of that type of bias. And that's one of the ways in which it can play out. You see a similar type of phenomenon with black and white applications for jobs actually out in the world in Chicago and the Boston area. Bertrand and Melanathan showed that identically credentialed black versus white applications, you just changed the name, were 50% less likely to get callbacks. So they were less likely to get interviewed. If you don't get interviewed, you can't get the job. If you don't have the job, then you're not represented in the workforce. And again, most people attribute these things to the unintentional rather than the intentional form of bias.
And that, I think a lot of the way people talk about racism in particular, it's an either or. Either a person is a racist, or the phrase often, they don't have a racist bone in their body. In fact, it sounds like most of us, probably all of us, have some kind of prejudice, aware of it, intended or not.
Well, let's call it a bias.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I think that the either or is an oversimplification. What I would say is a lot of people sincerely embrace egalitarian values, but being socialized into our culture, they learn stereotypes very early in childhood, on the order of age, 3, 4, and 5. They're firmly ingrained. They're frequently activated, very well practiced, and they end up being the default, or habitual kind of response. They get activated spontaneously, unintentionally, to the point that people aren't aware that they get activated. And that sets up an interesting predicament for those people. Their values tell them to respond one way, and these spontaneous reactions set them up to actually violate their values.
Talking to Patricia Devine, professor of psychology, director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison, about unintended bias, race, gender stereotypes, and how we can overcome them. Patricia, when you're working with people in the lab, and they're taking one of these tests, are they unpleasantly surprised sometimes by the results they get?
Absolutely. I mean, they're taken aback because a lot of people say, I'm not racist. I'm not biased. I actually believe in egalitarianism. And then they take one of these tests and it reveals to them that they possess the associations. They're in their minds, but they disavow them. And so it's unsettling. And one of the things that we try to do is to help people to understand that those associations, they learn them in a rather ordinary way through socialization experiences, in their developmental experience. And that having those associations doesn't make them bad mean, evil in any way. It just makes them actually rather ordinary. And so then there is the predicament, though. Your values tell you one thing. These responses set you up for failure.
We've been learning these responses, as you say, from a very early age. We've been building them up for years. That said, is it possible to unlearn them?
I think that it's possible to overcome them. I'm not sure if it's possible to unlearn them. I mean, so for example, I disavow gender bias, race bias, and a lot of other types of biases, but I could generate instantaneously what the stereotypes are, right? So I know I shouldn't act based on the stereotypes, but it's not as though my awareness or my knowledge of those stereotypes just goes away. So I think the challenge is to become tuned into when it is that you're most likely to think in stereotypic ways so that you could mark that event, you could pause, you could reflect, and you could generate other responses. And that's what we've been trying to do, is to develop an intervention that helps people to understand how prejudice can be a habit-like response, a habit of mind, and that those habits can lead to outcomes that they disavow, would rather not occur, and then to kind of create a concern about discrimination. And once those pieces are in place, they're educated about those things, we teach them strategies that they could take from our intervention, whether it's a workshop or, you know, some other format, and they could take those strategies into their everyday lives and practice them to try to overcome their biases.
Give us an example of what those strategies might be.
Well, one strategy would be perspective taking. Just taking a few moments to reflect on the experience of those who have historically and are in a continuing way stigmatized by their group identity. So taking a few moments to think about what it would be like in the STEM context to have your abilities called into question simply because you're a woman. It's not because of anything you've done. It's just by virtue of your group membership, or to be thought of as a terrorist because you are Muslim, or to be thought of as hostile and aggressive because of the color of your skin, because you're a black person and not because of anything that you've done. It turns out when people take a few moments to think about that, they start to think, that's not fair. I wouldn't want that to happen to me. And that they want to try to remedy this type of, they get empathic. They start to be concerned about the other. So that's one strategy. If people do this, just simply think about these things, it slows them down. They start to think about what kinds of responses they would rather have. So that's one strategy.
Is it that easy to do? Because I think, okay, I'm a white male. Can I really think that I can get inside somebody's head with one of these different perspectives that I haven't lived myself?
I think that people can learn that. For example, if you start to seek out additional contact with people who are from stigmatized groups, right? So maybe get more interaction with women in leadership positions or African Americans that you've not had that experience before. If you start to get to know people, that can feed into your ability to take their perspective, right? So that's a second tool, seeking out contact. Stereotype replacement is another strategy. When you start to be able to tune into when it is that stereotypes are most likely to pop to mind, what we say is that you detect it, you reflect about it, you reject it, and then you can replace it with a type of response that is more congenial to your values.
We're listening back to a conversation with psychology professor Patricia Devine from the UW Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab. She's discussing her research into conscious and unconscious bias and stereotypes and how people can learn to overcome them. You can join the conversation over on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think we as a society are improving over time when it comes to prejudice based on race? Have you recognized a bias that you have, and were you able to change that? Share your thoughts and see what others have to say over on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're listening back to a conversation about prejudice, bias, and stereotypes, and a UW-Madison project that aims to help people overcome them. And you can join the conversation with your comments and experiences over on the Central Time Facebook page. Have you caught yourself having a reflexive bias against a group of people based on race, gender, or other characteristics? Did you try to overcome it? How pervasive do you think bias and prejudice are? And do you see things improving over time? Post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Patricia Devine is a psychology professor and director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison. Rob Ferret spoke with her last month.
I wanted to ask, you do these interventions, you work with people in the lab. Does it stick around? Do these improvements stay with them over time?
We found that they do, and so that's the encouraging news. We've had the opportunity to look at the impact of our interventions over relatively short windows of time, on the order of 3 days, 2 months, 3 months, but also out to 2 years. And so one of the really important outcomes of our work is that when they go through our intervention, we see increases in the extent to which people become concerned about discrimination as a social problem. And I think that's a pivotal lever, if you will. Once you switch that lever, then they really want to know how to fix it. And they learn the strategies. These experiences stick with them. And then we see even 2 years later, people are more willing to challenge bias when others make bias statements. Or in our work with faculty, so you were saying in the lab, we've done some work in the field with the STEM faculty here at the University of Wisconsin. And what we found is that 2 years after our intervention, departments that had been offered the intervention compared to control departments were more likely to hire women faculty members. And the main problem in the STEM discipline, if it is the underrepresentation of women, hiring more women would be a benefit.
Let's go to our callers now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had an experience growing up with bias. My family was of Austrian descent, and everyone spoke the dialect, and I remember them clearly speaking about negatively about Jewish and African-American populations. And then I started dating someone who grew up completely differently and was not taught or did not overhear negative comments. And I just remember being in a room at a dance where we were the only white people, and I was just totally uncomfortable, and the person I was dating didn't think anything of it. And so that really kind of opened my eyes a little bit to what I had been experiencing as a child, listening to my relatives speaking negatively.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. And sometimes, I guess, cues are subtle. In this case, these were not subtle cues that Elizabeth was getting growing up.
Right. And I think there was the sort of stark contrast in your experience that could set you up for that kind of relative comfort versus the discomfort. The discomfort can be kind of instructive in some ways. And when people start to think that, well, maybe there's not a reason to be uncomfortable, it prompts people to think more about these issues and maybe sets them on the path to trying to address them.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. And along those lines, are there ways to raise kids, educate kids that don't reinforce stereotypes that might have been around for centuries?
That's a great question. I mean, everybody's interested in the idea. If we could intervene early, if we could prevent kids from learning those associations, then we would perhaps be more equipped to solve the problem. The real challenge is that the stereotypes are embedded into the very fabric of our culture. If you look at our media and you look at the kind of information that that children are exposed to, the real challenge is they learn them before we really have that opportunity to teach them what might be acceptable or unacceptable. And so that's challenging. With Kristen Schutz, who's a collaborator of mine in the department and one of our graduate students, Catherine Scott, we are trying to do some work where we intervene with parents to try to help them work with their kids to address bias. And we find that parents may be important contributors to the overall socialization experiences. But when children respond with bias, the parents are often mortified. And they're thinking, why would my child do this? And they can feel uncomfortable about that. And that may be a motivating factor that would lead them to try to figure out, work with us to develop strategies to work with their kids.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Scott on the line in Portage. Scott, hi.
Great. Thank you for taking my call. It's a good topic. I like this. My question is the study is just based on all races and sexes and religions. I noticed in the last few years that I'm a white male, middle-aged, blue eyes, and automatically I'm accused of, I can feel it and hear it all around me that I'm accused of being a homophobe, a xenophobe, and all those other phobias. And honestly, I feel I'm not. I mean, but I don't, at least I don't think I am. And I was just curious, is your study, is it that broad of a spectrum?
Scott, thanks for the call. So are you working just with, as Scott describes himself, average white people, or are you looking for prejudice, bias from anyone?
We've done a lot of work where we looked at prejudice of white people toward black men, toward women, actually women toward women too. But I think it's actually important to broaden the consideration because it's not only white people or men who are likely to be biased toward different groups. The concern, was it Scott? Was that his name? That Scott raised. I mean, I think it's really important that we're not taking necessarily accusatory tones, right? If people, because people can feel threatened and then they want to withdraw from opportunities to interact with other people. And the reality is a lot of the biases that we see, as I said before, are rather ordinary. There are these kind of habit kinds of reactions. And I think if people understand that problem, they may be more understanding of their own internal experience and they may understand better the experience of others.
Scott, thanks for calling in. We're talking about unintentional bias, how we can spot it and overcome it. Patricia Devine is with us. She's director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison. She's been working on these issues for some decades now. These obviously are sensitive issues, and as you say, it's easy for someone to become, in effect, defensive about it. How do you bring people whether in the lab or out in the field, how do you bring people into the process in a way that they're willing to participate and hear what you're saying?
Well, I think one of the things is to really understand that these associations learned, I guess I could say innocently, right? I mean, by being socialized into the culture. And to be very clear, that doesn't make a person bad. That doesn't make a person, you know, mean or evil, as I said before. But understanding the ordinariness of that type of bias against what people understand to be their values, I think it sets people up to recognize that the inconsistency doesn't suggest that they are racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever the group might be, but that they have this conflict, this internal conflict between what their values say and what the stereotypes suggest.
Do we know, is there research into, you know, our level of unintended bias and these reactions and overtly racist behavior? Does one necessarily lead to another?
No. In fact, I think among many people who would show these unintended biases on the overt level, they would never display those biases. They would not intentionally discriminate. Now, I don't want to be naive to suggest that there aren't people who will intentionally discriminate, because there are. We've done some work on the motive to express prejudice as well as the motives to respond without prejudice. And there are people who are intentionally hostile toward different groups. And the kind of intervention work that I've done, I don't think would be terribly effective with those people. I think that's a different entry point where you have to, provide different experiences that might lead people to question their current way of thinking.
As we mentioned at the outset, issues of race and other forms of bias are big parts of our national conversation. They're in the news all the time. From your perspective, doing the work that you do, what would you like to see us say differently in the media as we cover issues related to bias?
That's a great question. If we could control the media, it would be amazing. If we could alter the kind of images and messages that are provided to people. But I think if we could at least encourage people to consider alternative notions, you know, that encourage people to stop and think that when the media presents a message, it's not the answer. It's an image. Right. I mean, think about advertising. It appears that women love to do housework and they, you know, focus on all of those kinds of things. And many women do and they love it. And many women don't. You just at least encourage people to consider the alternative and to recognize the way in which biased processing or stereotyping, for example, can constrain the opportunities that would be available for people who are members of stigmatized groups.
We'll leave it there for now. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
That was Patricia Devine, professor of psychology and director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison, speaking with Rob Ferret. You can keep the conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. No matter how much any of us love our jobs, I think many of us have an idea of the dream job that we would drop everything for. Well, for cat lovers, this may just be it. The Just Cats Veterinary Clinic in Dublin, Ireland is looking for a full-time cat cuddler. Qualifications include having a lot of catitude, as well as soft hands and a soft voice to soothe skittish kitties. Stamina is also important, since the cuddler will need to pet and stroke the cats for long periods of time. And just like more run-of-the-mill job postings, there are also desired qualifications that can help you stand out from the crowd. Clinic staff say that, quote, an ability to understand different types of purring is a distinct added advantage in helping you secure this position with us. Well, if this is to your liking, you know where to go, the Just Cats Cat Clinic in Dublin, Ireland. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Pussycat, pussycat, you're so thrilling and I'm so willing to care for you. So go and make up your big little pussycat eyes. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat eyes.